ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Whether you're attending one or giving one, work presentations can be tough going.
I think one of the worst presentations would be people who can't read the room. They are giving you too much information at too great a speed, and they've lost their audience.
And sometimes presenters start by telling you, they apologise. They say, I'm so sorry, this is going to be a very, very dull presentation.
Oh, no.
And that immediately you can feel all the energy leaving the room.
Because it's time to bring that energy back. Hello, I'm Lisa Leong, and this episode sprung out of This Working Lifer Hannah's email asking, how can I tell better stories at work? Let's start with something that isn't helping, slides. And who better to ask than a teacher?
Hi, I'm Dr. Hugh Gundlach. I'm the Commerce Coordinator and a researcher at the Faculty of Education in the University of Melbourne.
Hugh, what is wrong with slides?
Slides are used in business. They're used in education a lot. There's nothing really inherently wrong with slides, but the way they're used is often quite inefficient. And I think a lot of us, we just get bored of them.
So if they're like that bad, why do we keep on using them, Hugh?
Yes, that's the good question, because I think in the digital workplace, it's just expected. So if you're not producing slides, you're not putting things up on a screen, and yet we've got screens in every room, in most businesses, in most schools, we've got a lot of seats facing that screen. If you don't use the screen, what are people meant to be looking at?
So Hugh, I got sent this slide pack. It was very dense, and it was actually a slideshow about why slides are bad.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that you created.
It is, yes.
Please explain.
Okay. So trying to completely remove slides is not my objective, and it's very difficult to speak to large audiences without using some sort of visual cue, because we're not all stand-up comedians. We can't paint pictures just with words all the time. We're also not all Steve Jobs trying to do a product launch in a black skivvy and jeans and runners. We don't have everyone in every audience always hanging on our every single word. So slides are totally fine. But if we're trying to improve communication, which is what slides are used for, that's the tool, I think we can do that better.
Kate Mason is a communications consultant and author, and she helps her clients get better at presentations. This is what she thinks about slides.
I hate a slideshow, Lisa. Anything that you put in front of an audience that is not yourself means that they're moved from you and they're looking and distracted by something else. So if you must have slides, have the bare minimum, maybe just the headings of each of your sections and a title slide, but that's it. Try to do the bare minimum when it comes to slides. Now, that's not always possible because sometimes we have graphs and data that we need to impart, but consider even putting a blank slide in your slide deck. So once you've shown the graph, putting then a blank slide up to bring people back to you before you have to show the next artifact. So you're kind of keeping them focused on you and listening to what you're saying rather than being distracted by font choice and colours on the slides, which really often happens.
What do you make of handouts?
Worst. Even worse, because then you've given people an opportunity to look down. And as soon as they're looking down, well, they're also then on their phone or they're thinking about what's next, and that you've really lost them. You've also lost the ability when they're not looking at you to see the interest or excitement or curiosity or displeasure on their face. And you really want to be looking at their faces to be able to see, I like to see nods, you know, of appreciation or feelings of like, that's really interesting, or I'll think about that later. If I'm seeing puzzlement, it means I probably need to explain things a little bit better.
Keeping the audience's attention is key. So what else gets in the way of that? I asked economist turned business storyteller Yamini Naidu.
I think people in business have a couple of fears. Firstly, they feel they've got no stories. Yeah, because they think, oh, I just live this ordinary life. I'm living the burbs. I drive, you know, four-wheel drive. I'm a vegan. Apologies to all the vegans. But that's what makes storytelling interesting, is if you use your personal stories. The second, Lisa, is a fear of self-disclosure. So in business, we're taught to be very safe, to, you know, drop straight into corporate jargon, to get all business speaky and stay safe behind what I would call a word salad. You know, all these meaningless words, ubiquitous, unprecedented change, innovation, cutting edge, all of these words that just mean nothing. So we've been taught to sort of slowly almost dehumanize. So I think those are the fears that hold people back from just finding a story and using it.
What I find in the workplace as well is that we spend so much time getting deeper and deeper into our expertise. To what extent might that get in the way?
That's a huge barrier. There's some really interesting research out of Stanford University done by Elizabeth Newton. So she had 250 pairs of tappers and listeners, and she gave them a list of popular songs, Happy Birthday, Jingle Bells. And she asked the tappers, how often do you think you're going to be successful? And they went, 50% of the time. And she did an experiment, and it turned out to be 2.5% of the time. 2.5%, so a really low result for such popular songs. And Newton tells us, like she concludes that when you know something, your knowledge curses you. For a lot of our listeners, it's almost like a bit like a backhanded compliment, because when you've got deep experience, expertise, skills, your knowledge actually curses you. You can't imagine what it's like not to know that. So normally experts carry this huge contextual piece in their head, this deep expertise. And when they're talking with, you know, a certain level of detail, they've lost their audience already.
Kate Mason helps presenters get over the barriers.
I think people get too caught up in themselves, right? So self-consciousness can take you out of a moment, or focusing on all of those open mental tabs we open. You know, am I being confident enough? Am I connecting well? Are they thinking I'm strange? Are they looking at my clothes? All of the things that we can get in our own head about are often the first things that get between a presenter and their audience.
You use the analogy of a tuner. Pray tell, how does this work?
It's maybe counterintuitive, but I think a lot of the people I work with are quite brilliant, and so they know a lot. And so in a presentation, there's a real temptation for them to say, here is this 600-kilo tuna. You know, behold, look at all the work I've done to make this perfectly big fish. And of course, an audience is looking at that thinking, how can I possibly digest it? So I often talk about, we all have that tuna, you know, internal mentally have a tuna, but how do we make it into sushi? How do we make it really digestible so that people can kind of metaphorically pick it up, examine it, take it away? And that's a really learned skill.
So if I am technically brilliant and I have that big tuna, where would you start with me?
What I often say is, explain it to me like I'm a smart 12-year-old. What is it that you're working on? Why is it interesting? Why is it new? People who've been working on something for a long time understandably take it for granted. And so they often come to you with halfway through the story. You know, they expect that you have knowledge that maybe you don't. So start as if I'm a smart 12-year-old, walk me through it, take me by the hand, and you'll often find that that will become a much more digestible way of explaining something.
And if I do have a lot of numbers, a lot of data, do you think that any story and presentation can be made interesting?
I do. It's just got to be made interesting for that audience. So again, think about what's the exciting thing? What's the lead that I'm burying? You know, what's the really exciting thing about this that maybe people might not know? Is there something counterintuitive or surprising about my research? And pull that out as a headline to say, here's this interesting statistic and here's how we got there. And it's really counterintuitive or surprising because we're all sort of used to that idea of explanation and resolution when it comes to storytelling. But I'm a firm believer that you can make something that on its face might seem boring, when you illustrate the behind the scenes or how you got there, it can be really fascinating.
What does listening to a good story do for an audience? Here's Yamini Naidu again.
In the audience, listening for a story does several things. It can often provide clarity. So they get, that's what it means at a human level. That's how our customer responds. That's what the community feels. So it humanizes whatever it is you're saying. So that clarity piece is really important, especially if you're doing really abstract, conceptual, you know, pieces. It'll help them remember. So later they'll be able to recall. People go, what was that presentation about? And 90% of the time go, I don't know. But this time they'll go, you know what? They shared blah, blah, blah. They shared the story about this customer. It creates connection. So through the appropriate storytelling, you can demonstrate that you understand your audience, that you've been where they are now, that you aren't this guru, you aren't the sage from the stage. You know, you understand them, you understand our customers.
And stories can be fun. Why have we buying into the stereotype that to be professional, you have to be boring? You know, you just have to... Stories are entertaining. People love them. They're fun. They make you laugh. They make you think. They provoke you. They make you angry at the injustice. So it can do so much for you. So story is almost like a Trojan horse of influence, particularly if you're trying to package a difficult message. A story helps people lower their defenses. Because, you know, if you try to pummel me with data and I get entrenched in my position, I'm just going to respond back in a hostile way, or even with other data. So we're just going to go bashing our heads together. But if, you know, you're going bang, bang, but what about this? What about that? And I go, actually, Lisa, for example, I was talking to one of our customers yesterday. I'm just in a moment, I'm just transforming the dynamic of that whole conversation. And I'm dropping our entire audience from their head, from this analytical, confrontational space straight into their heart. Because we are hardwired for stories. Remember, our survival depended on stories. That's how our ancestors made it out of the caves, out of the trees, onto land. And here we are in our homes and, you know, with roofs and electricity. Because of that, we hardwired to listen to stories. So your audience can't help but lean in and listen. And I always tell people presenting to boards, because this is my classic audience who works with boards, works with high-level strategic pitches that are run into billions of dollars. Don't be binary. Don't think, oh, I can only do data or I can only do stories. You've got to do both. This is what separates the really successful influencers, communicators, leaders from the rest.
Let's get a masterclass on how to build that story. Here's Yamini.
So if I just do narrate a string of events, if I go, I went here, I did this, I did that, I saw this, I came home. It's just a sequence of events. It's not really a story. What makes a story is some emotion. So your audience has to feel something. You have to feel something as a storyteller. And the twist, there has to be that turning point, that moment of conflict. Something unusual needs to happen.
So if we wanted to find, you know, such a powerful story for ourselves, how do we find that story and make it relevant and powerful, like that example?
Yeah. You do three things. You go on a story safari. You go on a quest. You gird your loins and you rub your hands in glee and you go, ha, 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 evil laugh. And you go out into your life. You go out into your business and you try and collect those moments, those experiences. Yeah, because so much stuff has happened to us. We've lived this rich life. We've got customers. We've got stakeholders. You go out and you get a coffee with your barista. Something happens. I want you to start capturing those stories. Yeah. The second thing you then decide, you look at one of the stories and you think, what message, what purpose could I land this in business on? Could this be a story about having courage? Could this be a story about adapting to change? Could this be a story about customer service? And then you practice, you get some help or some skilling. So this is the piece. So we all think we can story tell. But when you try to deconstruct a good story, you're like, I can't. I don't know what the bits are. So that's when you need some skilling and understanding story structure, beginning, middle, end. And then you need to practice. You need to do some prep and practice. And you get there by writing. Lisa, did you find in comedy, I was so shocked when we studied comedy. As soon as you walk in, the teacher says, the first rule of comedy is all comedy begins by writing. And that just blew my brains away. I was like, what? But I should know that because all storytelling begins by writing. You actually write down your story. You draft it out just like you would speak. And then you keep editing and refining it. And that's how you improve and get better.
I feel like an example of that would be useful right now. Yamini shares a story developed by one of her clients who's a risk advisor who grew up in the country. Okay, cue that mood music.
I always remember my mom, you know, she's always warned me about the dangers and risks in our property, right from like the dam, you know, the dangers of the dam, the red-back spiders and the snakes in summer. And she used to say, I'm teaching you this so you know what to do because I won't always be there with you. And there was this one, I remember this one stinking hot day and mom kept telling me to go and get my bike that I'd left at the bottom of the garden path. And I remember very reluctantly just dragging my body and going to get the bike. And I was just reaching to get the bike when I saw right in front of it, there was a copperhead snake curled up, basking in the sun. I almost was going to scream. But then I remembered what my mom had said. So I froze. I quietly started to step backwards till I was a safe distance, while still keeping my eyes on the snake, while I was a safe distance away from the snake. And then I screamed and I raced home to tell my mom what I'd seen. I often think about what my mom did for me that day. And the role we have as risk advisors. You know, Mum gave me the advice and the skills. I would have the confidence to know what to do. And in risk, we play a very similar role. We can't own and manage risk. Our aim is to give you, the leaders in the business, all the tools and knowledge. So whenever you come across your copperhead snake, regardless of what that looks like, you will know what to do.
That is really amazing.
And she actually, Rosemary was a client, and she used the story with great success, like not just with her colleagues, but with all the business units that she had to support. So it can show you, like I was saying, a story is a real Trojan horse, isn't it? So it helps you, instead of banging on about the same message, you just find a different way of communicating it.
Kate Mason draws on some very specialised experience she had as a young person when helping others.
I've debated since I was about 10, and I was ranked 9th in the world when I was 18. And one of the things that you're really looking at is how can you be most persuasive with your content, and how can you connect with people really, really efficiently? You usually only have about 8 minutes. So that has informed the way I think about coaching in terms of making things simple and compelling. But it's also informed the way I think about being able to connect and build rapport really, really quickly.
Is there any insight or structures or tips that you can share?
So in worlds debating, you have 15 minutes to write a 10-minute speech. And usually in life, if you're going to present something for 10 minutes, you'd spend hours, sometimes days. And so that sort of a discipline, I don't expect everybody to want to do that. It's not necessarily fun, but it's a really good discipline to think, could I sit down for 15 minutes and actually sketch out all the things I need? And oftentimes people I work with are really surprised that actually you can. That gives you, it really breaks the back of it. Just set yourself a timer for 10, 15 minutes and write down, here are the three areas I really need to cover. And often that simplicity really then comes through. You can layer on complexity of argument, but the simplicity of structure is really, really helpful for folks.
You mentioned that one of the worst things that can happen in a presentation is not reading the room. So how does reading that audience change the way you might present your material?
I think oftentimes when we talk about a presentation, it's not always to a massive audience. It's often to, you know, a room of eight or, you know, a small meeting at work. And I think one of the things that gets in the way of people really connecting with that room or reading the room is that they cling too tightly to their presentation. So they've rehearsed it perfectly. They've said it a million times. And so if the room shifts and someone says, oh, well, we're obviously not doing X, we need to do Y, and your whole presentation is on X, it can be really discomforting and strange to have to change and change gears. So as much as possible, I try and work with folks to hold things lightly, to be able to be flexible in the moment so that if something does shift and they need to make a bit of a pivot, they're not totally discombobulated in the moment.
When it comes to preparation, many people might do multiple rehearsals of that presentation. What do you make of that?
I think a little bit of rehearsing is great. I think most people over-prepare by a factor of a lot. So when you over-prepare, you really drain the lifeblood out of the content for yourself, and you drain the energy out of yourself. So you can see somebody going into second or third gear when they've it's so boring to them that they've lost all kind of energy and connection with anyone they're talking to. And you know when you're on the receiving of that, they're just going through the motions. So I always say to definitely read through the work and rehearse that. But instead of actually saying the words 400 times, just rehearse in your body. Stand up, move around, speak out a song lyric or something that you know, so that you're keeping your energy and your interest alive and not rehearsed into sort of a boredom.
Time for a coaching challenge for Yamini Naidu. You're presenting a business case for something you really need budget for, and you've got 60 slides of data and only 10 minutes. Go.
You always have to start strong. Start with fire. You know, we want to see Superman at the start. If you're courageous, I would say, would you be able to open with the story? What does life look like if you don't get this budget? So take us to that moment in the future where you are trying to do whatever it is you're trying to do, that moment of transformation, that strategy implementation, without any money, without budget. You can start with a really dark story. And that's the, you know, it's a dark start. And then boom, leave us in a better place than when you found us. So now this is your sliding door moment where you'd go, but I want you to imagine this scenario and then paint us a picture. What is that budget doing? It's not really about the money, isn't it? It's about the difference you want to make with that money. So when you find that emotional heart of a story, so in this instance, it's about the difference, that's when you'll find the right story to share.
But how do you know your story has been successful?
Often when you share a story, you'll be greeted by silence. And that's the first time that's ever happened to you in business, you know? Mm. And it can feel really uncomfortable, especially for a new storyteller. But I say silence in storytelling is golden. It's like your audience is giving you a standing ovation. They're clapping for you, but from their hearts on the inside. Because what has happened then is they're thinking about your story. Your story has sparked their stories. So that's the first test. What happens immediately in the room? The second thing is you'll find people start to reshare. They recall your story. They reshare it. They tell other people about it. So that's sort of the golden test. And the third thing you'll find that you get requests for those stories. People go, can you tell us about the Copperhead Snake? That never, ever happens with a PowerPoint deck, Lisa. Do you get repeat requests for a 60? can you tell me about slide 52 again, Lisa? Those 10 data points. Yeah.
Let's get some final advice for listener Hannah, who wrote to us, wanting to know how to stop relying on dull slide presentations and tell better stories at work. Over to you, Kate Mason.
Hannah, your colleagues, thank you. Nobody likes a dull presentation. So for one, it's certainly having less slides and making yourself more animated is a really good start to not having those dull presentations. But even if there's something like, if you know the audience you're going to be talking to, so if it is colleagues, bringing in a shared collective memory or story that you've all enjoyed together can be a way of bringing people literally together as they understand you. So you're sort of uniting them at the outset. That can be a really nice way of connecting and making them feel a little bit more at ease with whatever you're presenting.
And here's educator Dr. Hugh Gundlach.
So coming from the education background, we look at something called backwards design. So Wiggins and Matigue came up with this. You think about what's the outcome that you want? Is that skills that we want people to develop? Is it a value that we want them to adopt, some sort of behavior or attitude? Let's start with the end in mind and work backwards from there. So you might think, I want people by the end of this session to have learnt this training, learnt these skills. Start with that. What are the skills and activities I can ask them to do that will get them there? What's a measure of success? And plan accordingly.
And the final piece of advice comes from Yamini.
I want you to approach it with that new mindset to go, this used to be dull, but from now on, it's going to be fun. I'm going to make it as exciting as possible. And tell your audience this. Give them a challenge. Say, look, let's make this presentation. What are some things we can do? So just humanize it. Bring the people in the room in whatever way you feel comfortable. And asking questions, getting them to work in pairs is the simplest way. And don't think that's something I reserve just when I do workshops and when I facilitate. I can't. In 45 minutes keynote, I've got to be the only voice speaking right from the start till the end of the 45 minutes, possibly 55 minutes. No, don't do that. That's tedious. Nobody wants that. So those are my tips. Hope they help you, Hannah.
Yamini Naidu is an economist turned business storyteller, and Kate Mason is a communications consultant and author. Thanks to them both for their very useful and practical advice. And a big shout out to Dr. Hugh Gundlach, 2024 ABC Top 5 Media Resident who featured in and helped produce this story. You can get in touch with us, like Hannah, by emailing thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. You may remember our program about uncertainty at work. Well, we do have an antidote for you. Is constant change really all it's cracked up to be? What are the pros? What are the cons? We'll handle that next time. Thanks for listening to This Working Life with me, Lisa Leong. It was produced by Michelle Weeks and mixed by Carrie Dell on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. Until next time, work it like a charm.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.